Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, March 4, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the fraud on the market case, Halliburton v. Erica P. John Fund, being argued tomorrow in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to have with us two experts on today's call. We'll hear opening remarks from each of them in about 8 to 10 minutes each. We're going to hear first from Stephen G. Bradbury. He's a repeat guest here on Teleforum. He's a partner at the D.C. office of the Deckert Law Firm, and he's former head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the U.S. Department of Justice. He's going to start us off by describing the case and some of the arguments, and he'll be followed by Professor Michael Klausner, who's going to get into some of the broader policy issues and other points. Professor Klausner is the Nancy and Charles Munger Professor of Business and Professor of Law at the Stanford University Law School. And with that, Mr. Bradbury, the floor is yours.
Dean, thank you very much. Again, this is Steve Bradbury from Deckert, and I should let folks know that I'm participating in this case, the Halliburton versus Erica B. John Fund case, as counsel of record for a group of amici, the Chamber of Commerce of the U.S. and other business associations who have weighed in support of Halliburton, the petitioner. It's a very important securities law case. It's asking the Supreme Court to reconsider the presumption of reliance in securities fraud class actions that the court recognized back in 1988 in the seminal case Basic versus Levinson. And a little quick background, I think, is useful. This relates to private actions, claims for securities fraud in cases that involve alleged misrepresentation to the market. And as folks probably know, that's a cause of action that is not expressly provided for by Congress in the securities laws, but has been read into the laws by the Supreme Court. It's an implied cause of action under Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act, and Rule 10b-5 promulgated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. And back in the 1970s, when the Supreme Court was more inclined to do this, the court read into the law an implied cause of action for private plaintiffs to bring claims when they purchase stock in the open market based on the allegation that someone, usually associated with the company that has issued the stock, has made a false or misleading representation to the market about the performance of the company, or has failed to disclose certain material information to the market, and that as a result of that, the stock price has been distorted to the detriment of those who purchase the stock in the aftermarket. Now, in reading into the statute and the rule that implied cause of action, the Supreme Court looked to the common law of fraud for the basic substantive elements of the claim. And one of the essential elements of this private right of action for securities fraud is reliance. That is to say, the individual plaintiff must actually have relied on the misrepresentation that's being alleged to his or her detriment in order to sustain a claim. That's a basic element of common law fraud, and the Supreme Court has consistently affirmed that that's an essential element of this private right of action, including in the case at issue, Basic versus Levinson in 1988. But having to prove reliance as an element of a claim presents a problem if securities plaintiffs want to bring the claim as a class action. a collective action on behalf of lots and lots of shareholders. And in many cases, if not most cases, for the typical small investor, as a practical matter, that is the way that a small investor would want to bring a securities fraud claim, because in the typical case, a small investor didn't buy that much stock and his or her damages are not significant enough to justify hiring a lawyer, even on a contingent fee, and bringing a lawsuit. And most of those contingent fee lawyers aren't interested in bringing small lawsuits on behalf of one or two or three or five investors. They like to aggregate the claims into a class action. The problem for class action, however, is that the element of reliance is inherently individualized for particular plaintiffs. The question of whether an individual plaintiff has actually relied on the misrepresentation is inherently an individualized inquiry and does not lend itself to class action structure under Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which for the relevant category of class actions here requires that common issues of law or fact predominate over individualized issues. And so the concern from the plaintiff's perspective leading up to BASIC was that if each individual plaintiff must prove that he or she individually actually relied on the misrepresentation in purchasing stock, then they would not be able to group together and bring their claim as a class action. And, of course, the plaintiffs' counsel who represent class action plaintiffs would not be able to get the big attorney's fees and the payoff for bringing a large class action. That issue was addressed and resolved by the presumption of reliance that the court recognized in BASIC. Lower courts had begun to recognize this presumption leading up to the BASIC versus Levinson decision, and the Supreme Court in BASIC accepted it. It was essentially, interestingly enough, based on a kind of innovative or cutting-edge economic theory that started developing in the late 70s and into the early 80s that was led by the Chicago School of Economics and really a pro-free market type free enterprise perspective on economic analysis. And that theory is the fraud on the market theory, or actually the relevant theory is called the efficient capital markets hypothesis. And what that hypothesis suggested was that, and is, that the prices in a market that is open, what's called open and well-developed, highly liquid market like a stock exchange where there's a lot of units of stock trading, that in a market like that, the prices of the securities accurately reflect the value of the stock in the sense that all material information available to the public about the company that issued the stock is efficiently incorporated into the price of the stock. And based on that, what you might call conservative economic pro-free market, pro-capital markets theory developed most prominently by Eugene Fama, economist at the University of Chicago, plaintiff's lawyers seized on that concept in the 1980s. And began pushing the idea that if a plaintiff could be said to rely on this efficient market mechanism in purchasing stock, such that if the plaintiff could rely on the assumption that the stock price accurately reflects material information available to the public about the stock, then if that information is distorted by fraud, the plaintiff could be said to be harmed by the fraud and could be said to rely indirectly on the fraud through the plaintiff's reliance on the stock price when buying the stock. And that is the theoretical basis for the presumption of reliance, and that is what the court accepted in the BASIC case. Interesting case, BASIC versus Levinson. It was a 4-2 decision. A quorum on the Supreme Court is six members of the court. And the minimum quorum participated in the basic case because Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia were recused, and Justice Kennedy was just joining the court at the time, and he also did not participate. So the decision was a 4-2 decision. It was Justice Blackmun writing for himself, Justices Brennan, Marshall, and Stevens, and in dissent were Justices White and O'Connor. And for the majority, Justice Blackmun, in adopting the fraud on the market theory and the presumption of reliance, based that conclusion on three important factors, two assumptions and one very important qualification. The two assumptions were, number one, that in an open and well-developed market, what might be called an efficient market, the stock price, the price of that the stock is trading at in that market, will reflect all available public information about the company. Not that it, this is not simply an assumption that in an open and well-developed market, a misrepresentation, a material misrepresentation may distort the stock price. It's not simply an assumption that the trading price of the stock is affected by information about the company. It is an assumption that in such an efficient market, the stock price will accurately reflect the all available material information about the company. The second assumption, very important assumption, is about investors and what motivates them to invest in the market. And that assumption is very expressed in Basic versus Levinson decision. The assumption is that an investor buying into that efficient market does so in reliance on what the court called the integrity of the trading price of the stock. And by integrity of the stock price, the court made it very clear that it was assuming that the investor invests in the stock price on the assumption that the trading price of the stock accurately reflects the true value of the company in which the investor is investing. And interestingly, in dissent, Justice White questioned both of those pillars of the presumption, questioned both of those assumptions that the court made very strenuously. On the efficiency of the market, Justice White pointed out that this economic theory of an efficient capital market hypothesis was very new at the time, just a few years old. And Justice White pointed out that it's really not appropriate for the Supreme Court to base a whole doctrine like this, a whole procedural rule based on an economic theory that hasn't really been tested yet, and that the court is not in a good position to really verify. Courts are not the right channels for working out theories about economic actions in capital markets like this. The second thing is, Justice White pointed out that the assumption about what motivates investors is clearly not true for many, many investors, that there are a lot of investors out there in the market, including some of the most sophisticated investors, who, in fact, when they invest in stock, they do so consciously believing that the stock price does not accurately reflect the true value of the company, either that it undervalues the company or overvalues the company, and that's why they're buying or selling the stock. And in fact, some of the most sophisticated investors today, like Warren Buffett, for example, explicitly do invest based on what's called the value model of investing, which tries to do just that, tries to outthink the market and predict changes based on the assumption that the market does not do a perfect job of accurately reflecting the true value of the company. The third factor that was important to the court in Basic is a qualification, very important qualification, and that is that the court made it explicit that the presumption has to be rebuttable. And that's critically important because if the reliance element has any role to play, it is a causation role. And a plaintiff cannot sustain a cause of action for securities fraud if there's anything that has severed the link, the causation link, between the alleged misrepresentation and the harm or loss to the investor. And the Supreme Court, Justice Blackmun in Basic, made it clear that the presumption must be rebuttable, and it may be rebutted by a defendant in a securities fraud case by any showing that severs that link, that causation. And that showing could be that the alleged misrepresentation did not actually distort the stock. It could be that the any distortion in the stock price has worked itself out in the market by other information, et cetera. It could be that the market's really not efficient. If the defendant can show that, in fact, this is not an open and well-developed market, such that we could say with confidence that it's an efficient market, that would rebut the presumption. Or finally, the court said a defendant could rebut it by showing that the individual plaintiff did not, in fact, invest in reliance on the integrity of the market price. So the court made it clear the presumption has to be rebuttable. Now, the problem with all of this is, according to the petitioners in the Halliburton case, that the record in the lower courts of how the presumption has been applied in the 26 years since 1988 has demonstrated that there are serious reasons to doubt the validity of these underlying assumptions and this qualification on which the presumption was based. And in terms of the efficiency of the market, what you see happening in the lower courts is they've come up with a test that is rather reflexive and very nearly a black and white or binary test as to whether a market is efficient for purposes of invoking the presumption or not. It's a test for the most part identified with a district court opinion from New Jersey called the Kammer case. And the factors there that the courts have looked at are really, is there a lot of stock for the company out in the market? Are there a lot of analysts covering the stock? Is it traded on a big exchange? They also sometimes look at event studies to see how the stock is affected or just to verify that it is affected by information in the market. But generally speaking, if you're a big company and your stock is traded and has been traded for a while on a big stock exchange or NASDAQ, you're going to find yourself in an efficient market, and that box is going to be checked. And it's almost a rote or reflexive step in the analysis that's very difficult to rebut. At the same time, though, the economic literature and analysis by economists has matured and developed since 1988. So, in fact, you have some disagreements among economists now about the degree to which capital markets are efficient, not really doubting that they do efficiently transmit information. But the question is, how quickly do they transmit the information to the price? Is it different for different types of information, positive information, negative information, technical information, et cetera? And it's really a more nuanced analysis, a lot of economists have said. And it's interesting here, just a footnote, that just this past year, the Nobel Committee awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics to two economists, Eugene Fama from the University of Chicago and Robert Shiller from Yale University. These are the two economists who represent the antipodes on the question of efficient market theory. They take diametrically opposite approaches to it. They disagree about how efficient capital markets are, and yet they both just got the Nobel Prize. So that sort of nicely highlights the disagreements the complexity of the issue among economists. Nevertheless, the courts, based on the Supreme Court's decision in Basic, just continue to apply this binary efficiency analysis. In terms of the assumption about what's motivating investors to invest in the market, I think it continues to be even more clear today with Warren Buffett and others like him being very successful investors that not all investors out there in the market invest with reliance on that the stock price actually reflects the true value of a company. And then the final thing is on the rebuttable nature of the presumption. The real key here is what happens at the class certification stage, because it's probably no surprise to understand that the whole ballgame in these private securities class action cases is class certification. If the plaintiff class is certified, that's usually a prelude to a quick settlement of the case. Only cases that basically are not settled are cases that are dismissed for lack of pleading or at the procedural stage. But if you get past class certification, the case is going to settle. Only a half of 1% of these securities fraud cases ever actually go to trial. So trials basically do not happen. So the whole ballgame is at class cert. And the problem is at class cert, the presumption of reliance is effectively irrebuttable because plaintiffs have the ability to choose their lead plaintiffs. Plaintiffs' counsel chooses the lead plaintiffs for the class at the class cert stage, and they're always going to choose plaintiffs who can sign declarations that say, oh, yes, I relied on the integrity of the market price when I purchased. I wouldn't have purchased if I didn't think it accurately reflected true value. And it's not as a practical matter possible to test that proposition at class cert stage. And defendants get very little opportunity for discovery of absent class members at the class cert stage, and they're not going to be able to address individualized issues like this reliance issue. So effectively, the presumption has been irrebuttable. It's these problems that the petitioner Halliburton has brought to the Supreme Court's attention in the Halliburton case. And just last year, in a case called Amgen, four members of the court, that would be the four conservatives, not including Chief Justice Roberts, so Kennedy, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, all questioned the continuing validity of the fraud on the market presumption, the presumption of reliance. And so now we have a case that's going to squarely present that question, and so the Supreme Court is reconsidering the fraud on the market presumption, and for that reason it's a very important case. And with that, I'll turn it over now to Professor Klausner. To Mike, take it away. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Steve. What I think I'll do is address some of Steve's points regarding the fraud on the market presumption, and then go on to a set of points that are really underlying this case, which is a policy debate over whether securities class actions are too burdensome for whatever benefit they accomplish. So I'll try to do both of those in the 8 to 10 minutes that were allocated to me. The fraud on the market presumption, the basic claim, a little broader, I would say, than the way Steve has focused it, is that the fraud on the market presumption is not grounded in either law or economics. I think that's not quite right. The fraud on the market presumption makes sense as a description of what a securities market is, what investors in securities markets do, and what we want them to do. Now, it's true, Steve has said that there is some language in the court's decision in Basic that puts a lot of emphasis on, quote, efficient markets. I'm not going to quibble with that. There is language in that opinion that leans heavily on that concept. I think what that reflects is somewhat the times, somewhat a lack of specialization, of course, on the part of the justices in understanding what an efficient market is and is not. The basic point, though, is that an efficient market is not necessary to the fraud on the market presumption. It's clear investors don't rely on company disclosures in many cases. Many of them would never bother to look at them, nor should they, nor do we want them to. What do they rely on? They rely on an assumption that the company's disclosures are truthful. They rely on an assumption that prices, to some extent, reflect those disclosures. That's what Basic had in mind when it used the term the integrity of the market or the integrity of the price. It is not an assumption that the prices are accurate, in the sense of measuring true economic value. No one would say prices are accurate. It's not a claim that prices reflect only the company's disclosures. The prices reflect the totality of information in the market and the judgments in the market. I think that's an accurate statement that not many people could argue with. The point is that there is an assumption that they reflect, among other things, the fact that the company's disclosures are truthful, or an expectation that they'll be truthful. As a policy matter, we want people to assume that. We don't want them to have to look at the company's actual disclosures and claim that they relied on them. So imagine the following scenario. There's a material misstatement that's been made, and it's been made with scienter. There's a substantial stock drop at the same time. So So what's the concern with the efficient market? Is it that the stock drop was a coincidence, that it was totally unrelated? Now, the defense can argue that it was caused by some other factors, and defense counsel and economists that work with them do argue that. The defense can also argue that the information or the misstatement was not public and therefore didn't get factored in the price. There are a number of ways that the defense can argue that the price, that the stock drop did not reflect the misstatement. But the likelihood that because the market is not perfectly inefficient, the likelihood that the inefficiency resulted in a completely coincidental stock drop is vanishingly low. I don't think there's reason for anyone to be concerned about that. Now, so let's say that the fraud on the market presumption is based on a claim that stock prices are impacted by information that the company discloses. I think that's all we really need, and I think that's the best way to read BASIC. So that's really all I have to say about what Steve said about the BASIC presumption. I agree with him that there is language about efficient markets. My point is that that really is irrelevant to the concept at work, and that with what we now understand about markets, including what Robert Shiller would say about markets and what Eugene Fama would say about markets, no one would say that the span between them, that the difference between them, is a basis for saying that we shouldn't rely on this sort of presumption. Now, the policy concern, I think that's more difficult, and I'm probably somewhere in the middle on that. The claim is that the burden on business doesn't provide a commensurate social benefit. It's hard to measure commensurability, but let's see what we can at least tally up what the burdens and the benefits might be. First, the benefits. Compensation. In Steve's brief, he correctly argues that we can't claim there's any compensation going on in these cases. This money is making a round trip from shareholder to shareholder, with lawyers taking a good portion off the top. So I'm completely with Steve's position there. Deterrence. We can't measure deterrence, but I think there's good reason to believe there is some deterrence that's generated by these cases. About 5% of settlements involve individual payments out of a CEO's pocket or a CFO's pocket or both. CEOs and CFOs lose their jobs in the wake of these lawsuits. I've got some data analysis that shows that if you compare lost jobs of CEOs and CFOs following a securities class action compared to a restatement without a securities class action, the difference is 44% of people losing their jobs compared to 29%. Of people losing their job. So, and I'm sorry, this is a settled class action, not a dismissed class action. So there's reason to be deterred. Whether they are at the margin, we can't really say. What about the burden? There clearly is a burden. I don't have any quarrel with that. There is an unfortunate pressure to settle these cases on both the plaintiff side and on the defendant side. Whether that pressure results in a lot of non-meritorious cases being settled, we can't really say. But we can say that the PSLRA reduced that phenomenon quite a bit. So about 40 to 45% of cases are dismissed today. It's a pretty big number. Of the cases that settle, about half settle before the motion to dismiss is finally resolved. So these are cases that are settled not without some difficulty and some expense, but they are resolved without the extended discovery that is we all characterize this area of litigation with. You know, is there a better system? Probably. Is there a worse system? Yeah, there are a lot of worse systems, and it could be that the system that we would have if we simply get rid of the fraud on the market presumption today and do nothing more, that is, the SEC or Congress doesn't design a new system from scratch, but rather we just cut this piece out of the current system, we could end up with a worse system than what we have now. But let me stop there, and we can, I know Steve's got thoughts of what might happen if this case goes one way or the other. We can talk about that in the context of the Q&A.
Well, thank you both.
Over to you.
Thank you so much, Professor. In a moment, we're going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and we can begin queuing up these questions. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And we're about 30 minutes into the call, so I do want to get to the caller's questions. But before we go there, let me see if Steve Bradbury has a minute or two in response to what he heard. And then I'd love to hear from both of you on the implications. You know, how important is this case, and what are the implications of a decision one way or the other in the court?
Okay. Thanks, Dean. I'll jump in then. In terms of the reliance here, or the use of the efficient market theory, I think that we have to keep in mind, as I tried to emphasize, that the Supreme Court has made it clear that actual reliance on the alleged misrepresentation is an essential element of the fraud claim. And so the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the implied cause of action under Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 is not an insurance policy against fraud. So that just because there may have been misrepresentation or alleged fraud by a company, and just because investors may be harmed by it, depending on the timing of their purchases, the right to recover under this particular cause of action, the implied cause of action, is not guaranteed. That's not enough. It's not enough to show you were harmed and that there was fraud. The court has made it clear you actually, just like in an action for common law fraud, you actually do have to prove that you personally relied on the misrepresentation. There are some statutory causes of action that Congress did create in the securities laws that do not require reliance. Typically, the ones that involve direct privity with the company. For example, if you buy shares directly from the issuer and the issuer has filed a registration statement that contains a misstatement, a material misstatement, you can recover without showing reliance. But in this case, you do have to show reliance. So the only issue. The only issue is how do you prove that you did personally actually rely on the misrepresentation? And the court, in the basic case, allowed plaintiffs to prove it indirectly through this, if you will, this fiction that the market itself is the agent of the purchaser, the investor, and it communicates to the investor through the trading price the misrepresentation that the company allegedly made. And when buying the stock at that price, the assumption is the investor did actually rely indirectly on the misrepresentation. So there is a reliance requirement. You can't read it out. And the court, I think, did make it clear that it's this two-step requirement that the market must be efficient. It must actually incorporate, it's actually an assumption that it will incorporate all the material information efficiently, and then that the investor invested in reliance on that price reflecting the value of the company. But I do think those are essential elements, and if they don't hold up, if they're not well-founded, then the presumption collapses, I think, and that's the issue before the court. In terms of what's likely to happen if the
that is mine. You did it. Oh, I'm sorry.
If the presumption is eliminated entirely, then the question is, will cases of actual fraud be deterred Will investors be compensated for fraud they may suffer as a result of for harm they may suffer as a result of fraud? And I think the answers there are that the SEC remains fully empowered as an enforcer, and the SEC does enforce cases of fraud, and the SEC has authority to compensate harmed investors through restitution. The SEC does not have to show reliance, so this is not an issue for SEC enforcement actions. Similarly, large institutional investors, they're increasingly important as plaintiffs in securities fraud cases, like pension funds. They bring lots of cases these days. They buy lots and lots of stock. They carry a lot of weight and influence. They are fully empowered, fully capable to bring their own securities fraud actions. They do not need to bring them as class actions. They do not need to rely on this presumption of reliance. So those are two very potent enforcers, if you will, of cases of fraud. And I think that the deterrence factor will still be there. I think, you know, one thing to point out in terms of the efficiency of class actions as a deterrent or a compensation vehicle is that the Chamber of Commerce just last week released a report that was prepared by consultants at Navigant and a team of economists that shows really the loss in value to companies and to shareholders of securities fraud litigation versus how much compensation actually goes to investors. And it's 6 or 7 to 1 in terms of the loss in value to shareholders of companies through the loss in value of stock as directly as a result of the bringing of the class actions, not the fraud, the alleged fraud itself, versus how much money actually goes into the pockets of shareholders as a recovery from these cases. So there's a very strong argument that these are not efficient means to enforce the securities laws. So with that, I'll turn it back over, Dean, to you or to Mike. Thanks.
Professor Klausner, you want to respond before we go to the audience?
Sure. I think that the only thing I'll say is that I agree with Steve that reliance is necessary, but an efficient market is not necessary for reliance. And let me just give a hypothetical to illustrate that. Let's say that since the time BASIC was decided, there were irrefutable evidence that what happens, what the market does is that it impounds information, but only to 50% of its value. And we don't know why. We then say, I think Steve would be in the same position he is in now, saying we should overrule BASIC because BASIC assumed that 100% of information was impounded, and we've now learned that 50% of information is impounded. I don't think that would be a valid argument either, because the fact that 50% of information is impounded does not break the link between relying on the fact that the market impounds information, not all of it, but impounds information into price, and we want investors to rely on the truthfulness of the information that comes from the company. So there is just much weight being placed, not just by Steve, but by others that argue about this, on the efficiency of the market. It's just simply not necessary to the argument. If we found that market prices had no relationship to information, well, then I would switch sides. I'd be on Steve's side in a minute. Or maybe if the information was just, you know, the relationship was terribly attenuated, I'd switch sides. But we're not in that position now.
Once again, if you have a question, I'm sorry, go ahead. Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller on the line with a question. Actually, they just rung off. Now they're back. So let's go to our first caller.
Stuart Gerson. Hello, this is Stuart Gerson. I'd like the speakers to explore a possible middle ground, if you will, for the Supreme Court here. But I'd first note that as far back as 1936, Keynes talked about the operation of animal spirits. Alan Greenspan has written persuasively about it as a barrier to accurate forecasting in the last couple of months. And George Soros has written about it and made a career out of bucking the trend that the professor describes, that there are certainly massive investors that just look for the way the herd is going and will short them or do otherwise. But that said, I think Steve pointed out what the difficulty is with the presumption, and it's a question of probabilistics. If you can't challenge it at the certification stage, you're stuck with greater risk. Insurance figures very heavily in the settlement of these cases. However, in recent times, in the AT&T case and in Walmart, the Supreme Court has opened the way for the consideration of merits issues at the class certification stage, making it ostensibly tougher to get class certification. Is this a way that reliance in an individual case can be attacked without upsetting the presumption?
Well, let me jump in there. This is Steve Stewart. Good to hear from you. That is a factor, definitely, in Halliburton's arguments in the court, that the court in particular should reconsider how the basic presumption plays out and should be applied, or whether it should be retained in light of recent decisions like the Walmart case and the Comcast versus Barron's case that flesh out a new approach, if you will, to Rule 23 and to the question of what must be shown at the class certification stage to convince a district court that the plaintiffs have a valid basis to prove their claims on a collective basis rather than individual basis, in order to show that common issues predominate over individualized issues. That comes into play here a little bit more, I think, on the second issue that's in the case, which we really haven't talked about much, but it relates to the first issue. And the second issue in the case is that the petitioner, Halliburton, is arguing that defendants in these cases, that at the class certification stage, as a condition of getting the plaintiff class certified, the plaintiffs should have to show that the alleged fraud has actually impacted the price of the stock. This is what's called price impact or transaction causation. Short of that, if the plaintiff doesn't actually have the burden of showing that there's price impact at the class certification stage, the defendant should be able to refute, to rebut with evidence that there was not price impact. And what the petitioners here argue is that that's really part and parcel of the rebuttable nature of this presumption, and that in basic the court said defendants would have an opportunity to rebut this. And if they can't do it at the class certification stage, that's a right that doesn't make much sense. Now, the problem with that is that, as the respondents have argued in this case, the issue of price impact is a unitary issue. Either there was price impact or there wasn't price impact. So it's a little bit like the materiality question that was addressed by the court last year in the Amgen case, where a similar argument was made that plaintiffs should have to show materiality of the alleged misrepresentation at the class cert stage. And the court said no, because that's an issue that really goes to the merits, and it's an issue that's common to all members of the class. And the real issue for class certification is the difference between issues that are common to the class versus issues that may not be common to the class, and the question, do the plaintiffs have a model or a way to prove their claims through common evidence on those issues or not. And reliance is an issue that, absent the presumption, would be individualized and different for all plaintiffs. And so it's an interesting set of issues. But yes, the Duke, the Walmart case, the Comcast case, these are lurking in the background. They are an overlay to the issues as they're being argued in the Supreme Court. But that loss, that price impact issue, is viewed as a potential middle ground. In other words, the way it's sort of presented by Halliburton is if the court does not overturn the basic presumption but leaves it in place in some form, then maybe a fallback is, middle ground is, the court should require plaintiffs to class cert to prove price impact or allow defendants to disprove it.
Professor Klausner, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, just very, very briefly. I think that, Stuart, you began by talking about animal spirits. I just want to reiterate, I think that, you know, that's all correct, but I don't think it's relevant to this issue, because I don't think Keynes or Robert Shiller or George Soros would ever say that a identifiable stock drop is in a particular stock, which is what we're talking about here, is it all relevant to these other arguably inefficient elements of the market. I really think it's a very distracting set of apples that are getting into the debate about oranges. With respect to your question, I think as a policy matter, it would make a lot of sense to redesign the system in a number of ways. And sorting out this sort of question early in the process, which you can do without discovery, I think would make for a better process. I think there are a number of things that could be sorted out earlier, and I'd be, if we were writing a new system, and I'd be all in favor of that, that would be part of it. Another one, incidentally, would be something like a cap on damages. I think that the policy difficulty here is that you've got endless damages when you're negotiating a settlement. We could fix that as well with a different system. So I'll stop there.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are open at this point. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 10 minutes left on this call, and then we need to adjourn. Let me make an announcement while we're waiting to see if anybody else weighs in here, that we have another call on this same case tomorrow at 3 p.m. with practitioner Jeffrey Wall, who will be attending the oral argument in this case and then reporting to us, letting us know how things unfold. But, of course, today we're talking with Steve Bradbury and Professor Michael Klausner in a preview. If you have a question, this is the last call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Well, seeing none, actually, here's one final question. So let's take this question. Looks like it's from the Colorado area.
Thank you. This is Andrew Schwartz from the University of Colorado Law School. My question for both the participants is, assuming for the moment that the Supreme Court strikes down the basic rule and then Congress takes it up 3 days later, what should Congress do? What would be a wise thing for Congress to do to draft a rule to deal with this situation from scratch?
Well, I can address that. I think I just began to. I think addressing questions that can be addressed without discovery earlier in the process would make a really big difference. And I think somehow getting rid of the possibility of functionally infinite damages that the defendant is negotiating in the shadow of would be a big plus as well. I'm sure we could tick off a few others, but those are two that that come to mind.
Well, this is Steve. I guess I would urge Congress not to do anything. certainly not in the next, few days following a court decision, let's say, that overturns the presumption of reliance, but rather to see how things play out and to test the proposition that this will not create a situation where fraud will actually be encouraged and go undeterred and uncompensated. So I wouldn't think there would be a need for Congress to rush into any void there. And certainly it would be a very bad idea for Congress to turn around and try to, and I don't think this will happen because I don't believe it would be sufficient support in Congress to do this, but to codify this private cause of action for open market purchases private cause of action for securities fraud, and to do so without a reliance requirement in the cause of action. I think that would be pretty radical, and I don't think there's support for that.
I mean, it can't be that radical. The SEC doesn't have a reliance requirement. Section 11 doesn't have a reliance requirement. It's not that radical.
Well, those are much more. Those are more limited situations where.
Well, true. I'm just. I know. There's a difference. But I'm just arguing about radicalness.
Yeah, I think it would be for a system that has required reliance for decades now, for this form of open market private cause of action. But be that as it may, one thing I did want to point out is that in the private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, the PSLRA, Congress did address the damages issue there. Often plaintiffs would claim that 100% damages, if you will, based on the how far the stock dropped when the alleged fraud is disclosed to the market, and try to get 100% of that stock drop as damages. And in the PSLRA, Congress actually put a cap on damages in these cases and put that cap at, I believe it was the average of the stock price in, I think, Mike, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's in the 6 months following the disclosure that cures the alleged fraud. So they actually said there's a need to let the market wash out, not wash out, but let the market adjust to the new information over an extended period of time and reach something of an equilibrium in the trading price, and that would be the appropriate measure of damages and not the immediate impact. And it has been argued by Halliburton in this case and others that by enacting that cap on damages in that way, that suggests that Congress recognizes that the market may not be perfectly efficient in terms of how quickly it assimilates information, and that it may overreact to negative information. When a company announces that it made a huge mistake in its accounting last year, the stock price gets a big hit. And this rule, this cap on damages, suggests that Congress believed that that big hit was not necessarily an accurate reflection of the distortion in the price caused by the original fraud, if you will, or omission of material information.
Well, gentlemen, we need to adjourn this call 5 minutes early in 2 minutes. We have one caller remaining, so let's try and take one final quick question if we could.
This is Jack Park. It may have been addressed in Steve's last comments. What about the separation of powers? It would seem the court could jettison BASIC because it adopted it. The court could interpret Rule 23, but would we be correct in saying that any damages cap should come from Congress and any other tweaks come from Congress?
That's my view. Mike Klausner here. Yeah, when I was talking about how we might reform it, I was really talking about writing on a blank slate. I think it was in response to the last question.
Yeah. I agree.
One thing we might want to worry about, though, if we don't reform it, if the court does go this way, is there, you know, it's not clear it'll be any better. We still could have contingency fee lawyers working for institutions. We still have institutions that could bring suits based on their, you know, they're using other people's money. At least the lawyers, plaintiffs' lawyers, are using their own money. And then we'd have an institution bring an individual suit asking for compensation. There he would get compensation, no doubt about that, but he'd take it out of the pocket of the other shareholders. So I think there are a lot of problematic aspects of simply getting rid of the presumption, the fraud of the market presumption, and leaving everything else where it stands. But yes, I agree, Congress or the SEC, it should be their, it's their role, not the court's role.
I would just jump in there to say if the court does away with this element, this presumption, excuse me, or let's say it did away completely with the implied cause of action, I would question seriously whether the SEC has authority in promulgating a rule under Section 10B to create its own private cause of action here, to do what the court did by implying a private cause of action here. I would question whether the SEC has that authority under 10B, and certainly I would question whether it has the authority to effectively re-promulgate the presumption of reliance as a way to prove reliance. Because this private cause of action is judge-made creation. It is a creature of the Supreme Court, and I think it's rightfully for the court to address the elements of that implied cause of action and to address any anomalies in it. Congress could come in and codify it, but I would question whether the SEC could.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. I do want to thank Mr. Stephen Bradbury and Professor Michael Klausner for joining us today. This has been very interesting. To our audience, a reminder, we're going to be discussing the same subject tomorrow, but with some additional information. Our guest, Jeffrey Wall, will have attended oral argument in this case, so he'll be reporting to us with those details tomorrow at 3 p.m., and I urge you to join us there. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.